The Guardian.
England enters a three-tier risk system, but scientists and opposition leaders warn it isn't enough to stop the spread of COVID-19. I'm Jessica Elgott, Deputy Political Editor of The Guardian, and this is Politics Weekly.
The infection rate has quadrupled. Hospital admissions have gone from 275 a day to 628 a day in England. Yesterday, 441 COVID patients were on ventilators, and the number of deaths recorded was tragically the highest since June the 10th. That's the cost of rejecting the advice.
Labour leader Keir Starmer used a press conference on Tuesday night to call for a 2 or 3 week national circuit breaker, a dramatic escalation of his criticism of the government's approach. The call came after documents released by the government's scientific advisory group, SAGE, showed that Boris Johnson's cabinet had ignored most of the advice presented to them weeks ago to try and reduce the spread of coronavirus. So as the government abandons the science and the opposition stops supporting the government, where does that leave the rest of us? Well, if you're in some places in the north of England and in the Midlands, you're officially under Tier 2 restrictions as of midnight. In Merseyside, it's Tier 3. We'll discuss what that means later on.
As I said to the three presidents, put a tiger in the tank because...
In an already busy week, Boris Johnson will also have an eye on the Brexit negotiations as we approach the October 15th deadline that the Prime Minister insisted would be the final date for talks before needing to accept a no-deal Brexit. So how are the talks going? Plus, in the first of several interviews with chairs of Parliamentary Select Committee, Rajiv Sahel talks to Meg Hillier about how the Public Accounts Committee examines the value for money of government projects, like Brexit and COVID-19 spending. That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. But first, England has been officially split into COVID risk zones, and hotspots in the north of England and the Midlands have been placed in the middle category of the government's new three-tier system. Merseyside is in the highest category. To discuss the fallout from the latest government announcement, I'm joined by Helen Pidd, The Guardian's North of England editor. Helen, it's another pretty depressing week with regards to what's happening with COVID cases in the UK. Although I'm saying that from London, which is for now at least in Tier 1. You're in Greater Manchester and what tier are you under there?
Yeah, so I live in Stockport in Greater Manchester, which is in Tier 2, so the high-risk middle category, which was a bit of a surprise to me, to be honest. All weekend, I was expecting we were going to be in the very high-risk category with all of pubs and bars shutting. But in the end, the local leaders in Greater Manchester managed to fight that back, and poor old Liverpool City region is out on a limb. So me in Stockport, I live in one of the highest-risk regions in the UK, and yet actually, being in Tier 2 means that I can do slightly more than I could last week. So for the last 2.5 months, all household mixing indoors has been banned in Greater Manchester. And if you wanted to meet a friend, you could do it in a beer garden, but you couldn't do it in your own garden. But that rule has now been scrapped. So, if it was a bit warmer, I could have barbecues, as long as I don't break the rule of six in my garden. So there's lots of kind of confusing, contradictory things. And lots of people haven't quite got their heads around what they can and can't do.
It felt a bit chaotic on Monday, wasn't it? That negotiations were really going down to the wire about which region would be what, and it seemed like from some of the MPs that I spoke to that they found out from Twitter or from the television about which area what tier their region was going into. But it was sort of negotiated by Andy Burnham, really, wasn't it?
Well, in Greater Manchester, yes. I mean, he, along with his deputy mayor, who's Sir Richard Lees, who for the last 25 years, I think, has been the leader of Manchester City Council, they were leading the charge saying, don't put us into Tier 3 because that's going to kill us. And that's he maintains that position, saying that closing down hospitality, we can't recover from that. So, I mean, to an extent, government did listen to them, but there are strong rumours today that at the Gold Command meeting this afternoon, the government may well push Greater Manchester and most of Lancashire into this top tier. So there's a lot to kind of play for today, you know.
Do you think it does work, this simplification system, even though, as you say, for you, it has actually loosened the restrictions a bit?
Yeah, I guess so. Having a more consistent tiering system probably does make sense. And it was kind of a victory, particularly for the Tory MPs who were loudly pointing out that it was a bit daft that you could go to a beer garden but not have, you know, go and sit in your nana's garden and have a cup of tea. So it's probably the right move to smooth that one out.
So the PM made his announcement in the Commons, and there were places in areas of the country like the West Midlands. The West Midlands Mayor Andy Street made it clear that he was pretty devastated to be in Tier 2, and it went against what he'd expected. So was he the only local leader who was disappointed, do you think, or was caught off guard?
So Andy Street wasn't a lone voice, but he's arguably the most important voice because he represents such a large region. The West Midlands has about 2.8 million people living there. He's a pretty mild-mannered guy, you know, and he's usually pretty loyal to the Tories. And he was absolutely fuming on Monday because he had been led to believe that the government was going to listen to what he wanted and what every single leader in all the local authorities in his area wanted. And they did not want any extra restrictions to come in place. And he's keeping the pressure on. This morning, he has released a letter that he sent to Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor, demanding a series of things. So he has demanded that the furlough scheme continues at the same level as it did at the start, 80%. He's also wanting big funding to give out grants to businesses, and he wants some kind of extended tax relief as well. It's not just Labour MPs and Labour council leaders having a go at the moment.
And how fed up do you think people are of this north-south divide when it comes to the restrictions? I mean, according to Sadiq Khan, who's the Mayor of London, the capital is also at risk of heading for Tier 2. But yes, there's, you know, far less focus on that. Are things markedly worse in the north to merit this, or is it a case of, you know, a bit of a divide?
Well, I mean, our figures in the north and in the Midlands, so particularly in Nottingham, you know, they are worse than in London and the southeast, and particularly in the southwest. So you can't deny that. But the bone of contention is that we in the north of England have been subject to restrictions, as I said, for 2.5 months. And at the point at which we went under lockdown, which was the 31st of July, our rates were tiny. So, for example, Stockport, where I live, there were 24 cases per 100,000 people that week. And now there's 10 times that number. I think it's 266 cases per 100,000. But if you look at the figures in parts of the south that haven't had extra restrictions, they're far higher than the likes of Stockport was when we were put under the restrictions. So there is a bit of contention about that. But you've got to remember that actually the general public seem to be in favour of tighter restrictions rather than looser ones. So I think the kind of north-south divide is sometimes exploited a bit too much by politicians and maybe is not felt quite so much among the general population.
It feels like from those figures that we've just been talking about that local lockdowns haven't really worked. So why do you think the government's still continuing to push these localised measures?
Yeah, I mean, local lockdowns don't work. There was research from the Labour Party last week saying that I think 19 out of 20 areas that have been subject to local lockdown rates had actually doubled in that period. So, you know, there's strong evidence that they don't work. But of course, the government is very reluctant to kind of press the nuclear button and put us into a full lockdown, which we know now from the scientific advisers on SAGE that that's exactly what they pushed for 3 weeks ago. In the press conference that Boris Johnson gave on Monday night with Chris Whitty, the chief medical officer, I thought it was quite stark, actually, how open Chris Whitty was about the fact that he didn't really think that even Tier 3, this highest tier, was actually going to do the job and control the virus. I think that the government just wants to show that they've tried other stuff before they shut everything down.
On the other side of it, there's Conservative MPs, aren't there? And 42 voted against some of these restrictions coming in, including the 10 p.m. curfew overnight on Tuesday. Because Labour's is kind of backing the government on this stuff, it's all symbolic. But is it a problem for the government that there is this resistance within the Conservative ranks, and even more so if they want to impose something harsher like a circuit breaker?
Yeah, definitely. It's a headache that they could do without. And even though they've still got the numbers, because as you said, Labour are voting with the government, it can't be very comfortable for Boris Johnson, particularly, you know, if you look at it against the backdrop of the red wall, now the blue wall. You know, a lot of the politicians that are unhappy are those who have seats in the so-called red wall. And he's got to keep hold of them if he wants to get a second term, albeit the general election is light years away in terms of how time is passing at the moment.
And we saw Labour leader Keir Starmer kind of hone in on this in his first, it was his first televised press conference in response to one of Boris Johnson's. And he seemed to, it was one of, I think, a sort of key point where he broke with the government's strategy very clearly, calling for this circuit breaker. I mean, is that just him trying to anticipate something that will inevitably have to happen? Or do you think it's a risky move for him to make that call?
I don't think it's that risky, because I think he's probably quite confident that he's caught the national mood. There was a poll that was in the Times earlier this week which asked people, overall, do you think the current restrictions in your part of the country go too far or about right or don't go far enough? And actually the majority of people said they felt the restrictions didn't go far enough. So that would suggest that, you know, the general population is rather more cautious than many politicians. So they probably do feel quite confident that they've got voters on their side. So I don't think it's a massive risk. Of course, they will anger certain businesses, hospitality businesses and so forth, but it feels like a fairly canny political move.
And we've just also had stricter measures announced in Northern Ireland, which are going to come in very soon, kind of a circuit breaker, like with restaurants and bars closing for weeks and schools to close for an extra week around half term. How soon do you think we'll be hearing something like that in the rest of the UK at one of these press briefings? How long does the government have?
Well, I don't think they've got very long. But the problem is, in order to see the effects of these measures, you probably need to wait 2 weeks or so, and they don't really have that. I mean, the sort of conventional wisdom is that if they're going to do this circuit breaker, it makes sense to do it around half term, although lots of schools have different half terms. In Greater Manchester, among boroughs, they're different, so I don't know quite how they'll square that. I don't think it's inevitable that we'll see a return of a national lockdown, but I think it's increasingly likely.
Helen Pidd, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
After the break, we look at the Brexit negotiations and talk to the chair of the Public Accounts Committee. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Politics Weekly. I'm Jessica Elgott. Now, it was 5 weeks ago when Westminster was shaken by the news that the Prime Minister was going to try and pass the Internal Market Bill.
I would say to my honourable friend that, yes, this does break international law in a very specific and limited way.
The bill, which has since been passed in the House of Commons and is being debated in the House of Lords, would give ministers the power to unilaterally rewrite elements of the withdrawal agreement with the EU, which, as the government has itself admitted, would mean breaking international law. Many were up in arms, and the European Commission is preparing to sue the UK. We prepared ourselves for several weeks of intense talks, and then, well, it all went a bit quiet. For his part, Boris Johnson set a deadline for the talks, October 15th, which is tomorrow. So what is the latest on this not-so-oven-ready deal? To discuss that, I'm joined by The Guardian's Brexit correspondent Lisa O'Carroll and Mujtaba Rahman, the Managing Director of Europe in the geopolitical risk firm The Eurasia Group. As is common when we're recording everything from home, you might hear an odd sound in Midge's audio a couple of times. Lisa, I'll start with you. So back at the start of September, when there was this huge row over the Internal Markets Bill, it really sort of sent a shockwave through Westminster and through Brussels. And it seemed like then we were in for a very intense few weeks of Brexit talks. And that's probably been happening, although perhaps, you know, more below the surface because there's so much happening outside these talks. Can you tell us about what has been going on in the background and how intense it really has been?
It's still there in the background, but COVID is just dominating everything to a point that we are now looking at the self-imposed deadline for a Brexit deal, the one that Boris Johnson imposed, which is the 15th of October. And nobody's talking about Brexit. So the foreign ministers for the 26-27 member states are in Luxembourg to discuss Brexit and this internal market bill and the legal consequences of that. And we'll see where things are, but it doesn't look like we are anywhere close to a deal.
Mitch, can you kind of sum up for us, what are the two or three kind of big sticking points still, and how likely is a deal to come with them in the next few days? I mean, people you speak to seem to be a bit cautiously optimistic that some agreement can be reached on some things, but there's still a bit of a gap on other things.
It's the three issues that we're all well aware of, what the UK's plans are for its domestic subsidy regime post-Brexit. Within that, there are three issues, really. One is, you know, what principles is the government willing to articulate around how that regime will operate, and what is it willing to codify in a treaty with Europe? So kind of how much detail is the government willing to elaborate, and what is it willing to kind of pin down in legal text? That's one big issue. The second is the role of the domestic regulator and the powers it will have to prevent what the government wants to do regarding domestic subsidies. And the third issue is dispute resolution. So to the extent that Emmanuel Macron, French president, or Angela Merkel believe, you know, they have a problem with unemployment in their countries as a result of what the UK government is doing, what is their mechanism for remedy? They're the three issues outstanding on state aid. And I think there's been a bit of movement on the UK, but the EU side probably thinks the government needs to go further. The key offensive interest for Europe is fish, and the Access EU fishing vessels will retain to UK waters. And then the third issue very quickly is on governance and dispute resolution. So obviously confidence and trust has been hurt and undermined by the Internal Market Bill. And there's a desire really to pin down all the details of the agreement and the mechanisms that will allow the EU to retaliate in the event the UK decides to diverge from the agreement at a later date. And there is some backbench pressure, I'd argue, from the ERG in particular, on Boris Johnson to sign up to a deal, but then to diverge once the pandemic is over and the crisis in the UK is over. So I think that's probably a third issue where there'll need to be some attention and work over the coming weeks.
And Johnson and Macron did speak on over the weekend and ahead of these official talks that have started back up between David Frost and Michel Barnier. Lisa, how have those talks gone, and how important is it that sort of heads of member states have some involvement now in pushing the talks along?
Yes, so Boris Johnson spoke to Emmanuel Macron and Angela Merkel in the past few days, but the message was very much Boris Johnson has told both leaders how important it is to get a deal and how prepared Britain is to walk out with what they call this Australian style deal at the end of the year. So very much, you know, optically about the UK being able to set the tone for the talks this week. However, behind the scenes, I think one of the big problems is the lack of transparency in the UK. Everything is so infected by the political antagonism that has surrounded Brexit for the last 4 years. We've even had Lord Agnew, Cabinet Office Minister of State, before one of the committees this week, being terribly punchy about why businesses essentially will be to blame if this all goes wrong. And yet at the same time, saying that really what the government is doing is preparing for no deal. So in terms of optimism and what's going on behind the scenes, David Frost and Michael Gove were suggesting last week there may be some movement on state aid, which people were getting excited by. In Brussels, I think they were expecting some sort of movement on state aid this week, but fisheries is still the big emblematic thing, as we all know. It represents an absolutely tiny, tiny, tiny part of the economy, and state aid is actually the bigger issue. State aid has absolutely no cut through. Voters don't understand it. But I would be very, very surprised if either side will die on the hill of fisheries or die on the coast of fisheries. We're at a stage where member states are willing to make a compromise, but saying they're not going to make a compromise on fisheries until there is absolutely clear blue water on the state aid issue.
Do we expect anything, Midge, out of this EU summit on Thursday? The PM's basically said that that's the deadline for trade talks. Is there any sense he'll extend that self-imposed deadline, or it might just be allowed to sort of to continue in the background? How do you think it'll be presented?
Yeah, I think it's highly, highly unlikely that Boris Johnson or the government will walk out on the back of no progress on Thursday, Friday. It can't be fully excluded because there is some suggestion the government may need another crisis in order to sell a compromise that will ultimately see the UK moving closer to the EU position than vice versa. So the risk of another mini crisis prior to a deal being done is possible, and that may indeed be this context at the end of the week, although I'm a bit more sceptical that will now happen. I think this is more, frankly, for the EU side to have a conversation collectively among the 27 leaders about where they stand on the Brexit question. They've obviously not yet done that. There was an agenda item discussion at the September Council, but that was really von der Leyen and Charles Michel just briefing leaders. There really wasn't much interaction among the 27. And I do think this week, Michel Barnier will brief EU leaders on progress, and then we'll see something of a debate, I think, among the 27 about the best way to proceed. And I suspect what they'll do is signal a willingness to continue talking, and while at the same time ramping up and preparing for their no-deal preparation, because a lot of that no-deal prep does require work with member states and the European Parliament. That will take time to work through. But I suspect what they will do is signal some clarity around the process going forward and the need to further intensify talks to try and secure a deal by the end of the month or early November, because if the timetable were to slip much beyond mid-November, it then actually does get very, very difficult to see an agreement being implemented without the disruption of a no-deal first.
Lisa, do you think it's politically difficult for Boris Johnson to allow talks to continue past October 15th when it was announced with such fanfare, or you know, as you said in your introduction, the fact that this has kind of slipped a bit from the public gaze, and because the issues are so technical and not, and apart from fisheries, very difficult to kind of make a political point about, that talks could quietly continue, perhaps even until mid-November, and a compromise could be reached that way, or whether there needs to be some sort of walking out crisis to allow a concession to be made a bit later on. How do you think it will play out?
I think there will be plenty of people who will forgive the government for allowing talks to extend. I think nobody can understand why he imposed this deadline of the 15th of October, when in reality everybody knew, and Barnier has been saying all along, middle of November, early December is when they think a deal will be struck. It will be difficult for them presentationally. How do they get past this October the 15th deadline and say they're going to continue without a breakthrough? That's what I find interesting. So who knows?
Where's the space where a deal might be done? Where do you think the EU could give ground, Mitch?
What's new about the more recent discussions is the narrative has moved off those ideological sovereignty terms, and we're now actually talking about state aid as a policy problem. So a problem that can be fixed in policy terms. It's a technical discussion. It's no longer a highly political, ideological one. So I think that in and of itself suggests that the gap on substance is narrowing, because officials I talk to on both sides tell me, of course, there is a fix on state aid. It's not dynamic alignment, which was the original request from Europe and which Theresa May agreed to in the political declaration. So this would see the UK following EU rules in perpetuity. Well, that's not something this government is going to agree to. At the same time, there has to be more than what's known as non-regression, which is on the other end of the spectrum. And that effectively means the UK will agree not to go backwards, will not go beneath the standards that are in place at the time it leaves the EU. So the fix to state aid, frankly, is somewhere between dynamic alignment on the one extreme and non-regression on the other. On fish, the problem is we're still talking about this issue from a somewhat ideological perspective. Fish is a big deal for Boris Johnson. I think if he wants to do a deal, I mean, ultimately the question we've got to ask, if Boris and Macron are going to do a deal, can they sell the deal back home domestically to their respective constituencies? Boris needs a win on fish. I think it's important to the ERG, the right of the party, because they don't care about state aid, but the idea of the UK as a sovereign coastal nation is symbolically important for them. That suggests agreement is still a bit further away.
I think the tensions around fishing are centred on the English Channel, and there are plenty of other states who have issues, including Spain, Scandinavia, etc. And I think people would be prepared to be, as Mitch has said, be strategic, and I cannot see Macron on his own winning an argument to block a deal on the basis of a domestic problem he has with those who fish in the English Channel.
Michael Gove said last week he thought there was a 66% chance of a deal, which is quite an optimistic and specific, I guess he sort of means two-thirds chance, one-third for no deal. Do you think he's about right? 66%? Would you put it out? What percentage would you put the chance of a deal, never mind by a couple of days' time, but, you know, before the end of the transition period?
So we're at 65%, Jess, actually. So I was I was quite happy to see Michael's number, frankly, right. And I wonder whether he's seen my piece and has decided to base his percentage off our probabilities. But in the event there is a deal, I don't think Parliament will have the bandwidth to scrutinise it. I don't think people will care about the detail because everyone's so busy on COVID. But if the government does not land a deal, then I do think it becomes a macro problem for Parliament, and that becomes a big wedge the opposition can use against the government. And I think the government wants to avoid that. So they're the reasons why we have our 65% number with upward pressure.
Simon Coveney last week in the Irish Parliament made the very, very good point that the most anybody can hope for at this point is a very thin deal. It'll be significant because it will allow tariff-free and quota-free trade. However, it will also involve years and years and years of talks to come, you know, in relation to lots of things. We can speculate what they are: contribution to science programmes, cooperation on policing, defence, justice. There will have to be temporary arrangements put in place, even for stuff like data transactions and data movement of data across borders, which is a very, very sensitive issue.
Sounds like we'll be talking about this for quite a few more years to come. Thanks very much, Midge and Lisa. That was The Guardian's Lisa O'Carroll and Mujtaba Rahman of the Eurasia Group. Now, Boris Johnson's government has been accused in the past of running away from scrutiny. Civil servants who raise concerns about ministers or policies find themselves being forced out of office, which makes the role of parliamentary select committees all the more important. Since 2010, their chairs have been elected in a secret ballot, and it has given a new career route for smart politicians, which is free from the BDI of their whips and party leader's office. At their best, select committees can uncover policy scandals, corruption and waste through public statements and evidence or testimony. In the first of several interviews with chairs of select committees, The Guardian's Whitehall correspondent Rajiv Sayal spoke to Meg Hillier, the Labour MP for Hackney South. For the last 5 years, she has chaired Parliament's spending watchdog, the Public Accounts Committee, which draws on the work of the National Audit Office.
Meg Hillier, thank you so much for joining us today. Given that the first 6 months of the crisis has cost us $210 billion, how daunted are you by the task in hand?
Well, I have to say it helps that I've been doing this for a while, because I do know kind of where to start looking, and from an early stage was pressing government to make sure that there was a proper process for watching where the money is going. Because the danger is, in a pandemic like this, working at pace, the government will work to get money out of the door. But if you don't have the proper accounting procedures in place, which sounds really boring, but then you can't go back and track it. So from that very early stage, I was saying you need to get your accounts in order, and was making sure that we did everything we could from the parliamentary end to press that point. And also make sure that for every pound spent, every £1 billion spent, we're watching to see what we get out of it. And I think that's really important, that you don't lose sight that money is being spent for something to be achieved, even in these difficult circumstances. And you've got to still hold government's feet to the fire about whether they achieve the objectives that they set out to achieve.
Is it realistic to ask your relatively small team of staff and a handful of MPs, sometimes with competing political interests, to track and evaluate government spending on such a huge scale?
Well, let's not forget that, of course, the Public Accounts Committee, which was set up in 1861 by William Gladstone, been around a while, but has always worked with the National Audit Office or its predecessor bodies. And we are very fortunate that there's 850 brains in Buckingham Palace Road who do the digging through the numbers. And it's an extraordinary resource that a lot of people don't really know about or understand. So that is extraordinary resource. And that means that we know when we get to looking at something, we've got the numbers, they're accurate, and then we can apply our skills, if you like, to looking at how what's gone wrong and also what could be changed to make something go better in the future. And that's one of the key things that I've been trying to work on as chair of the committee over the years.
You said earlier that you are obviously very concerned about the auditing procedures, because that's the way in which you can track whether or not government spending is producing an effect that is desired. But often you in the NAO criticise the government for failing to monitor either its spending or the cause and effect of political decisions, which means that they can't evaluate if a policy works or if money is being spent wisely. Do you ever suspect that this neglect might be deliberate to avoid proper scrutiny?
When you get a civil servant sitting in front of you repeatedly saying that's a decision for ministers, you know then that there's been a very strong hand come in from the politician to do something which may not be quite the way that the normal processes would have allowed. And there are various documents, things like the Green Book, which is a guide to how to spend public money in a proper way, putting in those checks and balances. So coronavirus has ripped up those checks and balances, which allows potentially, and we think we've seen a bit of this more direct political hand going in and making a doing something on the hoof without those normal safeguards. But on the money front, only recently we've been looking at how the government has worked in dealing with our exit from the EU. And from the beginning, from 2016, there wasn't a budget line for departments about how they're spending on Brexit. So it's been a bit of a catch-up job for the Treasury to collect and analyse where spending has been made on Brexit and what it's actually achieved. So we've obviously done some of that ourselves, and with the National Audit Office has, the Treasury is catching up. But that was quite shocking. And it's an example of one of the reasons why I was very keen from the early days of COVID, however difficult the situation, if we don't keep a track of the money at the very beginning, then you'll soon lose track of that accountability. And that transparency and accountability are really the heart of what the Public Accounts Committee is about. Because if we can get out information into the public domain, then we and others can analyse that and make sure that civil servants who are our witnesses, we don't see ministers in my committee, and hopefully ministers will realise that they can't get away with something because it will be there in front of the Public Accounts Committee in that very public arena in very short order.
You mentioned not calling ministers to give evidence to your committee. Does this give politicians a way of shirking responsibility? And would you like the power to question ministers too?
No, we are very clear. We're looking at the economy and the efficiency and the effectiveness of how taxpayers' money is spent. So we deal with the accounting officers. That's the senior civil servant who's responsible for watching the money. Of course, ministers appear before their departmental select committees. And I've made it a very big part of my role as chair of the Public Accounts Committee to work very closely with our sister committees, those that are looking at those issues. And we have now an interesting system, which is quite unknown, I think, to people out there, that we can have this thing called guesting on a committee, which means that a member of another select committee can attend. For instance, I'm working quite closely with Hugh Merriman, the chair of the Transport Select Committee, and we have guested on each other's committees. So we're injecting our knowledge from our perspective. We found that to work very well when it's properly planned.
Your recent report into the Home Office pointed out the department had no idea what its £400 million a year immigration enforcement unit achieves and lacks diversity at the top of the department, risking a repeat of the Windrush scandal. Should we consider the possibility that the department is institutionally racist?
To make that judgment as a committee would be out of our remit. I mean, I have perspectives on this as a busy inner London constituency MP. And of course, you know, over a decade ago, I was a Home Office Minister dealing with some of these and grappling with some of these very issues. I think what I would say is the pace of change in the Home Office is very slow, that it's never popular for politicians to announce they're going to invest in an immigration system that actually is efficient and effective, because it costs money to make turn around these people's cases fast. And I think that there are lots of systemic issues there. I certainly would agree, though, that there are decisions that the Home Office has made. And I think this reflects very much that diversity issue that we reflected in the report, that doesn't understand some of the needs of the people it's serving, because the background of people in a lot of our senior jobs in the civil service is quite narrow. I think actually you talk to most senior civil servants, they would recognise that. The question is, what's being done about it? Now, we were looking at the effectiveness of money spent. So this is where, you know, as you say, £400 million spent on immigration enforcement with very vague aims about protecting people from harm, but then not being able to prove or even approximate how effective different types of action are. So if you raid a restaurant with illegal staff, are you really protecting people from harm? I mean, how are you measuring that? And it was very, so we were looking at what they said they were going to do and what they've achieved and how they could prove they got there. And it was too vague for us. We like to, on the Public Accounts, we can see numbers, targets, dates set. And that sounds very boring, but actually it's a very good way of holding both civil servants, but also ultimately their political masters to account.
You mentioned COVID, and obviously that's going to be the issue that I presume is going to dominate much of the PAC's time. The NAO is looking at COVID contracts, and they've been much concerned about the number of contracts that have been given to friends of Boris Johnson's inner circle without putting contracts out to tender first. How concerned are you by this, and will your committee be examining this particular practice?
Well, I am concerned because we, as Parliament, gave this government pretty much unprecedented powers outside wartime to make decisions quickly in order to protect the public and save lives. And that was, I think, it has to be the right thing to do in the end when you've got a pandemic like this. But that should not have meant that there was a complete break on normal protocols. And what my worry is that that has become an excuse to pick up the phone to someone the Prime Minister knows and just offer them something. And obviously, those rules are in place to make sure that civil servants can stand up to ministers and say, you can't do that, Minister, because that's not proper. And it worries me a lot. You know, I've had the privilege of on this committee as we can call for people, papers and records, as we put it. And I've seen a lot of confidential documents from government that we seek and we read together as a committee. And, you know, there is a lot of concern I have generally about outsourcing, because one of the things we can do as a committee is we can look at everything that's going on in the public sector. We can get, and the National Audit Office can crawl through any numbers in that area. But once you get into the private sector, you've got a whole element of public service run by private companies, which we don't have access to in the same way. We have access to the public side of the contract, but not how that private company is operating. And so we're outsourcing large swathes of public services, and they just don't have the same level of scrutiny. And that is a real concern for me.
Speaking of external contractors, we've seen this week that the government is spending huge amounts of money on management consultants. The Guardian reported that consultants for Brexit have cost about $450 million in 3 years. And it was revealed this morning that Deloitte has more than 1,000 consultants working on track and trace. Are you concerned about this? And is the UK's spending on management consultants under control?
Well, funny, we raised that this week with the Cabinet Office as a real concern, particularly we were looking at particularly at Brexit spending. And I've seen a lot of those contracts, and they are, what worries me is they're contracts for consultants on things the civil service ought to be good at, which is the policy side of it. It is completely legitimate. And as a committee, we certainly have never said you should never have any consultants, because there are certain very detailed technical areas where you might need somebody to come in and advise a civil service which doesn't have that skill. But you need to really watch how it's the money spent. You need to be really clear about what you're getting from those consultants. And as I say, I've had the privilege of seeing some of the documents that some consultants produce, and not all are as good quality as they should be for the money that's being paid. And I think, you know, we've got to get a balance here. And one of the things that we think we can do as a committee is by constantly asking questions about this and pushing it, we can make sure that when those accounting officers are in front of us, they have to defend their use of consultants and be clear that when they're asking them to do something, they do need the consultant, they can't do it in-house. As I say, in the end as well, we don't get the same oversight of that. Whereas if, you know, an MP were to ask a parliamentary question about what a department was doing, we could get quite a lot of information. Once it's gone into the private body, bits of that aren't in the public domain. And I think that's something that we've got to be very cautious about.
Meg Hillier, thanks very much for joining me.
Thank you very much.
And just to say, in response to Rajiv's reporting on Brexit consultancy, a spokesman for Deloitte said, "We are confident that our work adds significant value to public sector organisations we work with. Deloitte works closely with the Home Office, its agencies and police forces, assisting on their largest and most complex programmes and building and delivering new technologies." There will be a link to that piece on today's episode description on the Guardian website. But that's all from us this week. With less than 3 weeks to go until the US presidential election, in this week's Politics Weekly Extra, Jonathan Friedland and Raphael Baer ask and try to answer the question, what effect will this election result have on America's relationship with the rest of the world? Then make sure to listen into that this Friday. Just look for it on our usual Politics Weekly feed. But for now, I want to thank our guests, Helen Pidd, Rajiv Sayal, Lisa O'Carroll, Mr. Barahman, and Meg Hillier. The producer is Danielle Stevens. I'm Jessica Elgott. Please look after yourselves, and thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.